Okay. By the way, thank you to Christine and everybody else who put this together. That is the most incredible spread I've seen. That's beautiful. Okay, so let's get back into Roman numeral 3 on our outline, which is science meets God in physics. Remember, it's only a recent thing that we divide the sciences into the different disciplines, like physics and chemistry and biology. Physics, the study of nature, or natural philosophy is what they originally called it back in the 1400s, basically included all science. And I think for all rational inquiry into natural phenomena, we can eventually boil them down to physics. Physics, you know from probably school, sitting through some class someplace, had you thinking about very, very big things like galaxies and black holes, and very, very small things like atoms and photons and quarks. We're going to start with the big ones first. This is from May 25th of this year. Can science explain the beginning of the universe? When you research this, there are hundreds of articles within the past year about this in pretty well-known or just under the well-known, but pretty reasonable websites and magazines. They're all over the place. Why do you think science is trying to explain the beginning of the universe? What's the motivation by these people? Yes, they're getting a salary from their university, but at some point they really do want to know why the universe is the way it is. Where did it come from? It's an interesting topic to atheists and who are interested in being atheists, as well as to Christians. Well, at the large scale, the physical universe we call the cosmos. There was a really great Discovery TV series not that long ago about this. Where that cosmos came from is the topic of cosmogenesis, or cosmogony, which has recently popped up in the science world. We Christians call it creation. And basically where it comes from is, and we're going to see how this is done, but if you look carefully at the sky with the right kind of instruments, you can notice pretty easily that everything up there seems to be rushing away from everything else. The best model for it or physical thing that we would be familiar with is, if you're making a raisin bread and you make a dough that's, say, this big and it's full of a cup and a half of raisins, and you figure, what's the distance from raisin to raisin in this bread? Let's say it's about a centimeter from raisin to raisin with all bread in between. And then you put it in the oven or you let it rise, and this little bread over here goes and it becomes this big loaf of bread. And now what's the distance from raisin to raisin? It's much bigger. And the funny thing is, if you actually do this, and you could, your kid can do this on a computer in 2 minutes when you get home. If you actually do this, you'll see that every raisin moves away from every other raisin. They're all receding from each other because the universe of the bread is expanding in size. And so it's not just that raisin A is going toward or going away from raisin B, but actually going toward raisin C. Nope. From A to B and B to C, all those numbers are increasing. No raisins are going toward each other as the bread expands. One way of saying, you look up there, everything's moving apart. So tomorrow, the universe is bigger than it is today. Literally, everything we look at, all the stars, all the galaxies, are farther apart. The universe is bigger than it was today. What does that mean about yesterday? It means it was smaller. And a lot of yesterdays, there's only so small that you can go. Okay, so there is a bound. When you say something's getting bigger or getting smaller, it can get bigger forever, but it can only get as small as nothing, as zero. And this was the thought of a scientist not that long ago, and he said, the universe must have come from one point. It must have been one tiny place. And the problem with that is, and it's not, this is, again, first year physics class in 10th grade in your kid's school. it's really easy to show that when things get smaller, when a thing of a certain amount of mass gets smaller than a certain size, nothing can escape from it, not even light. That's called a black hole. And you don't have to resort to any calculus, any fancy math at all. It's really, really basic how a black hole occurs. And the black hole ratio, in other words, of mass to size, as you're collapsing this universe down smaller and smaller, you pass that a long, long way before you get to what the Big Bang is like. And so it's kind of very difficult for physicists to come up with what could be powerful enough to pull mass apart in such a way. That has to be the uncaused cause. Oh, sorry. That was very dramatic there. So I didn't say the Big Bang. I say, so let's start with the big light, because that's the first thing in the Bible that God says he did. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the Lord said, let there be light. So we need to think for a second, and we're going to go more into the science world than the Bible world right now. We need to think for a second about what light is. Yes, you're all Bible people here, and you all probably know that the Bible loves light imagery, and it does it all, that uses it all the time, and there's a reason for it. Let's talk about light. So we're drilling down on this phenomenon that we use to gain access to most of our world. I don't know where my prism went, but I had a prism and I brought some little colored lights, but you've seen this before. This is when white light goes through a prism, it refracts. The different frequencies, meaning the different colors of the light, get bent by the light different amounts. It's basically the way that when you hear a car go down the road, as it's close to you, you can hear all the high-pitched sounds. You can hear the rushing of the gases out the back, and you can hear the wheels on the pavement. But when it gets far away, all you hear is the low-pitched rumble. Low frequencies don't get bent as much by stuff. High frequencies get bent more because they're smaller, basically. If you take, this is the little thing over here, if you take a tube of, you just take some mercury out of a thermometer and heat it up and take the gas that comes up and put it in a sealed tube and put a electrical current or electrical voltage across there, an incredible bright, bright light shines. And if you put that light through, if you put that light through a spectrum, through a prism, you get these different colors at different spots. That's an emission spectrum from the element mercury. So elements have a signature. These patterns right here are a signature of mercury. This is the wall of my study with the mirror that I ripped out of my binoculars and against the sun. That's a turkey, a feather on the wall. And that's actual sunlight in my actual house about a week ago. It's pretty cool. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. They're all right there. You can do that very, very easily. This is from a hot thing called the sun, which has lots and lots of different things. This is a different kind of a spectrum, but it's the white light coming in, and it's actually made of all these different colors of light. This is how you collect light from space. This is the Mount Palomar telescope. We know quite a bit about space because we have devices like this. This is the thing opens up at nighttime and the light bounces off this. This is a 200-inch wide mirror, which took like 9 years to make. It was made more or less by machines, but by hand. There weren't computers in there running, in those days, running the grinding machines. It has a very, very even parabolic curved surface, and that I think it's aluminum on the front surface of it, and light from stars hits that mirror and gets concentrated into this little area up here and ends up going into, it used to be just a regular eyepiece, now it's a computerized camera, but that's how we see stars really carefully. When we see them, we do spectroscopy on them. So we put the light more or less through a prism, and we see, we're looking at this one little star over here, this one particular star, we can see this, all these colors come out of one particular star. That's breaking the star's light down into its component colors, or we say frequencies. That's what colors are. Here is that example before. This is the fancy light going through a slit, going through the prism and spreading out. There are a couple of things that we can notice about lights. Number one, if the light is running away from us at a pretty high rate of speed, the light gets what's called redshifted. That means it becomes, its frequency with which we see it, lengthens out. It's just like the ambulance that goes past you on the street and it goes, as it goes past you, the frequency goes down. Low frequency corresponds to red. High frequency beep corresponds to blue. Yes?
One question. So does the spectrum, when it breaks it down, does each star have its own unique signature, like a thumbprint that only that star throws out this certain array of color or whatever light?
Excellent question. The answer is there are about seven kinds of stars. Of individual stars. There's also galaxies, which make light also. And when you're looking far away, you can't tell if it's 100 million stars or one star because it's so far away. But the answer is not every single one like a snowflake. Think of it like the nine different kinds of spices that you have in your drawer. So there are certain kinds of stars that have certain signature looks. The signature look can be so distinguishable. In other words, the lines line up in such a way that in relationship to each other, you can say, oh, this is a Cepheid 1 variable star because it has this pattern. As a matter of fact, you just fed into the next thing. So here is a certain star, and we get this is exactly a spectrum. These black lines exist in the spectrum too because those are places where the light is blanked out. The atmosphere of certain stars absorbs certain frequencies, so you see a black line there. You see nothing. There's no light. Notice that these lines are in relationship to each other, but they're moved over in this particular one. So this is a star that's at rest, a certain kind of star. Let's say a type 2 yellow star. Here it is. When you look in the sky and you see another star, it looks just like it, except it's moved over this way. That's called redshifted. So the thought is, the logic is, those two are the same kind of star because they have the same signature, except one is shifted over because one is moving away from us, right? Similarly, if you see the same thing and you see it shifted this way, you say, oh, that one's coming toward us. It's blue shifted. This is tedious work. This is staying up all night long in an observatory someplace. This is a master's thesis or a PhD thesis for some poor kid who was an astrophysics major. But for better or for worse, there have been thousands and thousands of these kids who've gone through school, and there are thousands of people who have jobs like this because they're interested in this sort of thing, and they pay them something. And they live and they do this. So we know a lot. And what have we discovered? We discovered that, and I'm not going to go into how we figure how far away stars are, but there's a relationship between how red they are and how far away they are. The farther away the stars are, the redder they look. And that means the farther away they are from us, the faster they're running away from us. And that's why that's another reason why we believe, and logically it does seem like we are in an expanding universe. Getting just sort of parallel to this, how do we know what's going on in the universe? Well, there's light coming in from those stars. Now, sometimes the light's radio waves. Radio waves are a kind of light. X-rays are a kind of light. Cosmic rays are a kind of light most of the time. Light is the way we communicate all information, with some minor exception. All information comes to us via light in this material universe. That's a thing that really struck me doing this. Information, knowledge, transmitted thoughts, words, or 8 bits equals a byte. Any bit of information actually gets into our brain through light. Now, you might say, wait a second. I can hear things. That's not light. That's sound. At a certain level, though, what sound is air pushing on your eardrum. And that air is made of atoms that have electrons on the outside. And so does your eardrum molecule. And when those atoms come close to each other, they push on each other, and that moves your eardrum. One of the greatest physics teachers who ever lived is a guy named Richard Feynman. This is a Feynman diagram that you see up here. He was the guy who discovered this concept, which is actually proven true many, many times now, that what push means, when I push on something, what's really happening at the ultra-microscopic level is photons, little bits of light, are being exchanged between the electrons that are pushing on each other. Physical push involves electrons. So there's hearing, which is actually just pushing. Your eardrum is a pressure receptor. Sight, sound, touch, obviously. You could say, stroke your hand 3 times and it means yes. That's touch. How about smell? Smell, a molecule is floating into your olfactory epithelium up here and locking into some receptor you have up there. That molecule is pushing on this molecule using electrons. All information comes to us via photons of light. Now, I presented this to Sam, my son, the other physicist, and he said, it can't be true, can't be true. He called up his boss, who's a PhD in physics, and he says, any information besides that? They're quant traders, and they actually did this. So, you know, a neutrino is an ultra-small particle that does not react, does not work against things using electromagnetic interaction. It reacts using what's called the weak force, which is very weak. Neutrinos can go through the Earth. They can be detected. My last slide at the end of this is a neutrino detector, which is a tub of dry cleaning fluid that's the size of 2 Olympic swimming pools, that's 400 feet underground someplace in a mountain, surrounded by light detectors to look for neutrinos. But anyway, these quant guys tried to use neutrinos to shoot them through the Earth from one side to the other to get ahead of trades that were going on light beams around the Earth the other way. So there is one other way. But anyway, all information travels on light. That's very important. If you read your Bible in Revelation 22, it talks about when the new heavens and the new earth are created. This is also mentioned in Zechariah 3, which is what we're starting in Bible study 2 weeks from now. In heaven, there's not so much. It says that in heaven, they will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light. The Lord God will be their light. So God is the light of that place. Heaven's a different kind of a place where we don't need photons for information. Information travels in the mind of God in heaven. Here's why we need to know about light as Christians and to speak about light as Christians. Because this is the most familiar, probably verse in the Bible to you. In the beginning was the Word, which is a bit of information, and that Word was God, and the Word was with God. So the Word was and somehow separate. And he was with God in the beginning, and all things were created through him, that's Jesus Christ, and apart from him was not one thing created. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. Who wants to take a shot at what that second or fourth verse means? The life was the light of men. What do we think that means? How do we read that? Come on. I know at least half of you have puzzled with this and come to an answer. The life was the light of men. What is the relation? Yes, Kate. Something like that, okay? So that light, there's an information. Word is information, and light is information. And man's life, the light of man, is different than the light of anything else. Because man can apprehend his God. That's why man is different, ultimately, why man is different than animals. But the light of men is that life that comes from Jesus Christ. And the Bible understands that and teaches this. And everything we learn about light in the scientific world is consistent with that. Yes, John?
So ergo, the opposite of that is man loves darkness. So if you like the dark, you're not getting the transmission of this creation of the reality of the Creator, right?
Yep. This was the judgment. Everyone who does evil hates the light. We all naturally hate the light. That's the natural darkened state of the man's heart, is to hate the light. And so we don't come to the light. Our natural state is for fear that, what's the ultimate thing? That who we are wrong, our sin will be exposed. That's, so when we deal with the unsaved world and the science God question, remember what we're dealing with is someone who at the core does not want his or her deeds to be exposed. That's why it's so difficult for non-Christians to pray. They can do anything. You could tell a non-Christian, come to my house, we're going to have a Buddhist ceremony, we're going to hum, we're going to hum, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to lay on the floor in a contorted position, and we're going to invoke the spirits of the undergrowth. And they do it. Let's sit there and we're going to say, dear Jesus, come into my... I'm not doing that. You've seen this. You know this. The scandal that Christ is. The inacceptability to the world comes from... the Bible explains it pretty carefully there. Now, getting back to the quite interesting science here. So information, the rational pursuit of this science tells us, always moves around via light. Light is made of indivisible tiny particles, which are actually bigger than you think and more accessible than you think. I brought experimental equipment tonight. Debbie has already looked at this, but I went to a very expensive lab and had these built. These are post-its that I cut in half with a scissor and retaped again a little bit apart. And you can pass this apart. Just look through there and try to see the parallel lines that form as you see that. And then we'll talk about why those parallel lines are there. That's a little experiment we can do, talking about light. In the meantime, we're going to talk about starting smaller than most light particles, most photons. This over here is an atom. These are numbers, scientific notation. They mean whatever they mean. But if you blew this up, your typical atom, say an atom of hydrogen or oxygen, until the nucleus was the size of a handful of blueberries. Remember how the nucleus, the protons and neutrons are in the middle and the electrons are buzzing around the outside? If you made the protons and neutrons into a handful of blueberries and put them on the middle of the 50-yard line in a football stadium, the electrons would start, for the most part, up in the cheap seats in the football stadium. So blueberries from the 50-yard line up 150, 60 yards away, electrons. What is your atom mostly made of? Mostly made of is space. It's empty. There's nothing there in most of matter. Atoms are supposed to be indivisible. The concept of an atom was come up with by a Greek philosopher in about 450 BC. But atoms really aren't the smallest thing. We know that right now. Protons and neutrons, electrons are smaller, except people can start bashing up nuclei and breaking those protons and neutrons down. Now, these other particles called quarks are indivisible. They're invisible, and you never see them in an unbound state. And then people have theories about where those things come from. as we go smaller and smaller, it gets harder and harder to know what we're even talking about in terms of reality. Nonetheless, atoms in matter are not the smallest bit. This is atom, nucleus. This is the inside of a proton. Those are the quarks and the gluons going around inside there. How do we know this? We know this from experiments where they basically use fancy magnets to accelerate bits, ions, charged particles, in or other particles, into each other, and they smash them, and they see where they go, and conclude these things. These cost billions of dollars. On the other hand, when you're dealing with energy, not mass, not matter, you were talking about particles called photons, which are indivisible, and they are just like waves because you had those post-it notes. And when you look and see those little lines, what you're seeing is the diffraction pattern exactly the same as a water wave would make going between two jetties. The troughs of the waves are coming out of that slit in the paper, are hitting the crests and canceling out, and you get that black line there. And you can see it. So that slit that I made with a scissor and scotch tape is on the order of the size of the light that's going through there. Visible light is not that small. That's why we need electron microscopes to see small things, because their electrons are much smaller than visible light. And it comes in discrete packets. There's a smallest amount of light of a given color that you could have. That's called a photon. Physics, on the big side, is general relativity. It's the science of galaxies and of space and of the curvature of space and black holes and whatever truly unscientific idea we have right now as to what made the universe go from smaller than your hands to bigger than anything we could think of. We have no explanation. The idea is called inflation. It disobeys the cosmological principle, which is that things are the same in time and space, because space was different then. It had to have been different then. On the small side, you run into quantum mechanics, which in the lay world right now, you will see reference to in terms of quantum computers, but we can scientifically establish that certain things cannot be known. That's called uncertainty. And to establish the unknowability of certain physical parameters is an amazing thing. The philosophy of it changes everything that we understand. So my favorite physics teacher in the world is this guy named Feynman, and you probably can't read this, but when he says, and he's probably one of the greatest physicists whoever lived, he says, I think I could safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. You work with it. Some of you probably do. My son works with it all day long. But whatever it is, however complex it is, and however unwieldy and however proving the unknowability of things it is, here we are. It still works. All the universe still functions. So as we break things down, analysis means breaking things down into component parts. We try to make break down a substance into its atoms, break down light into its photons. The process of breaking things down is different than understanding the whole plan, right? So someone says on your team at work, we want you to really drill down on this, but you need a manager over everything to understand this team's work and that team's work. Point is that in nature, we run across lots and lots of examples of things that are made of the same thing, which are different. The example I like is, these are all things that you can make out of wheat and milk. If you have ravioli for dinner, or pizza, or a cheese sandwich, or a bowl of cereal, or a pancake, or a cream puff, you're eating wheat and milk. The ingredients are the same. The atoms are the same. Manifestations of those atoms are very different. This is what the psalmist says. Open my eyes that I may see wonderful things in your law. The psalmist is looking for the laws of God, and he knows that his eyes are closed. we as Christians need to realize that it's the action of the Holy Spirit in our lives who works for God to show us Jesus Christ, to open our eyes, and in the midst of what looks the same to the outside world, to show us the hand of God. Everybody read Psalm 119. It's the longest psalm about the law. Here, the psalmist there says, I long for your salvation, O Lord. May your laws sustain me. Salvation, laws, sustaining. We are physically sustained by the physical laws of the universe right now. And as a Christian, to think that we're at odds with those laws, or that those laws prove or disprove the existence of the lawgiver, is senseless. So I want to get to this nothing buttery thing. First of all, who does that look like to you?
Shakespeare.
Very good. Who does Shakespeare look like? It is Shakespeare. Good for you, Gail. I think it looks just like Remy. It looks exactly like Remy. It looks exactly the same eyes. Okay, so nothing buttery is what some English science writer talks about as the problem with reductionism. In other words, reducing things to nothing but. So this is another one of the ploys of the atheist against theism. Not against Christianity, we're going to get there, but against the idea that there's God. The atheist says, well, the universe is nothing but those small particles, those photons, those atoms that we were talking about. And to say that it's nothing but is to say that the works of Shakespeare are nothing but a bunch of marks on a page, a bunch of letters. And if you think that, as an atheist, Shakespeare says, okay, you try writing one. This is the argument of the monkey. How many monkeys at typewriters does it take randomly hitting keys to write Macbeth? For how long a time? Reductionism, this is a thing I want us all to be aware of. It's a dangerous way of thinking. Reductionism and deconstructionism is part of a different talk. But there are a lot of isms out there in the world right now which carry huge stock in the academic community. Reductionism is one of those. Nothing buttery means it's nothing but its component parts. Don't fall for that. Do we have time? Oh, we're almost out of time. Okay, let's just touch on this. And this is probably one of the things that are closest to a lot of Christians' hearts. The origin of life. This is where science meets God. And great scientists, great atheists, biological scientists, have again and again run up and been honest and said, I'm sorry, I have to tell you that there is no explanation for what we see in our experiments. Spontaneous generation was what a lot of ancients thought. We talked about mice coming from cheese before. This was actually considered science. People would put meat in a corner and it would turn into maggots. And they said maggots come from meat because they didn't do enough science yet. And I said, oh, that's silly. People did more and more science, but people still couldn't understand where living substances come from. You need to be familiar with this one. In 1953, two scientists took they took a glass ball, and they put some water in it, and they put in it methane and hydrogen and ammonia, right? Three small little chemicals, and they heated it, let the steam rise up that contained those things, and then these are Tesla coils. They make sparks, and they sent sparks across. And they did it for 2 weeks, and then they analyzed what fluid was in that vessel at that after that time, after just sparking those very elemental basic molecules, chemicals, ammonia, NH4, NH3, methane, CH4, and hydrogen, H2. And lo and behold, they got out 5 amino acids. And that was a huge thing in the world. People were scared to read the newspaper. Oh, they've proven that they can make life in a test tube was the headline every place. We've explained where life comes from. We don't need God because we got these chemicals, which are life chemicals. Well, just want you to know, these are the chemicals they got. They got four amino acids. Glycine is the simplest amino acid, and these other ones here, which are pretty simple chemicals. The color picture over here is a model of histone. Each one of those regions is probably 300 or 400 of these big. And the way it's wrapped, this is what wraps your DNA up into a chromosome. Go back one. This is the Krebs cycle. Each one of these chemicals going around over here is used in how all organisms that use glucose for energy using oxygen get the power out of the glucose. All I can tell you is that the simplicity, what they got out of there, these four molecules, has nothing to do with, or almost nothing to do with life. The proof, what does this tell us? The world was ready, was looking for, to say, to get God out of the equation. And by saying these four little chemicals, and this shook the world back then. If you look at the old articles about it, people's faith was just shaken by this Miliuri experiment. It's nothing. Anyway, fast forward. This was from June 3rd. It's June 10th right now. This was 7 days ago. Scientists announced a breakthrough in determining the origins of life on Earth. This was in a reasonably decent science source on the internet. And I want to read this to you carefully because it really shows the mindset of the atheist science. One community revisits classical questions, i.e., where does life come from, with complex chemical schemes that require difficult chemistry performed by skilled chemists. That means the Urey group that we just showed you. Their beautiful craft work appears in brand name journals. That sounds so funny to me. However, precisely because of the complexity of this chemistry, it cannot possibly account for how life actually originated on Earth. This is another atheist scientist telling you about all the other atheist scientists' work that's been done in this area so far. He says, and they say, it cannot possibly account for it. In contrast, the Foundation did this study, and they did a simpler approach. It turned out that the glass of that container was very necessary for those little biomolecules, those little protein molecules almost, amino acids, to be formed. If they did it in a Teflon container, it didn't happen. These guys put some pieces of basalt glass, and they cooked that same mixture, they cooked something else, and they got RNA. RNA, which is like DNA, the molecule that encodes life. And they said, look, we got RNA. Except, look what they put in. They put in nucleoside triphosphates, which, if you remember from high school biology, remember ATCG? They put ATCG in, and they put ATCG charged with three phosphate groups, which is where the energy comes from. So they basically put in spring-loaded base pairs, and they put them in the bowl with pieces of glass, and they got out some chains of RNA that were 100 base pairs long. That's nothing. I mean, they didn't do anything, but they did manage to clobber all prior life experiments like Miller and Urey. Bottom line, mud plus lightning does not equal life. That is the prevailing viewpoint in the atheist scientific community right now. Among everyone, if someone tells you that it does, you know they have a dog in the fight. You know that they are an atheist. You know that they are fighting against the truth that's right in front of their nose, which is, we need something else. How close can we come? Can we write an equation? Well, we can write this. Life equals matter, biological life, plus some kind of energy, plus information. We have to know where to put all those molecules, plus something else. We don't know what it is. Okay, you can do it all, but you can't animate it. What does the Bible say? The Bible says in Genesis 2:7, And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. So this mud does not equal lightning, or mud plus lightning cannot equal life. Be careful, it's all over. Every nature show you see, it's just all over. Closing down, I'm already over. Okay, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. So loved the world in the Greek is the cosmos, cosmon. God loved the cosmos. It's not, and the world, cosmos is the Greek word for world, but it means world that's ordered. So cosmos stands apart from chaos in sort of the way the Greeks write. God loves order. God is a God of order, of law. And God loved the world. This is a cheesy picture, but it gets the idea. The idea is that the order that he put into his physical law is part of the way he cares for us and loves us. When God said, let there be light, he let information into the world. It's such an interesting thing. You know, talk about Genesis. What day did he make the sun? Day four. On the fourth day, God made the sun. And yet on the first day, there was evening and morning the first day. Without the sun being there, it's hard to know what those times mean. So, closing down. God and science, big topic. If you put that into your Google right now at your seat, you will see that it gets approximately 5 million hits for that topic in quotes. Christ and cosmos gets far fewer. Why? Well, number one, we're talking about the idea of any general God. And when we talk about Jesus Christ, it narrows it down to the Son of Yahweh, the God of the Bible. As Christians, what do we need to know? There are some people who you're going to start your gospel evangel, start just explaining them about what you believe by starting with God. I mean, most people know, but there are plenty of people with whom you say you start with the idea that there is a God. And that's a reasonable thing and sometimes is necessary to do. But skip down to the bottom over here, right here. We do know from our verse earlier, I wish that thing would go away, that the heavens declare the glory of God. We do know that the cosmos is what God loved, and that the law that God made for us is what sustains our physical selves here on earth. And we need our physical self in order to be a spiritual self. That's the way we're built. The heavens do not proclaim the mercy of God. The gospel that God loved the world and spoke into it, and when we disobeyed, spoke into it with his own Son made flesh, is not proclaimed in science. Science only goes so far. The proclaiming the mercy of the Lord is our job. We have to be very, very careful with our relationship to quote-unquote science. Yes, Christians have all kinds of warts, and there are Christians who hate scientists and, you know, the whole business. That, as far as I can tell, the Bible loves science. The Bible wants you to be as rational a thinker as you can possibly be. Little side bit. Watch out for this word demiurge. Okay, so you know the Proverbs 8, where he personifies wisdom? There's a whole cultic belief system about Sophia, the other God alternative. Don't go look it up, but the fact that God created the world through Jesus Christ, through his Son, has caused some people to come up with this concept of demiurge. It's a Greek word that basically means public servant. It means like the guy who fixes the windows in the town square. Don't be fooled by this. That's a whole cultic belief system, which is pretty present, at least on the internet searches. Finally, the last thought. When we're dealing with studying the earth, studying nature, studying the cosmos, we have to constantly be aware of it is the Lord's. And the fullness thereof, what does that phrase mean? It means every little bit of it. The world and we who dwell within, for it is he who founded it. upon the seas and establish it upon the flood. If it were earlier, we would break for questions. We can maybe take a couple if you guys want to hang around for a little bit, but these are topics that I hope to go through on Sunday after church, because Dan's not going to be there for Sunday school, so I'm going to take the after church Sunday school, which is going to be in this room, hopefully, and I'm just going to, if you can't read them, I'm just going to see if the topics resonate. You probably know people who are young earthers. You might be wondering what the day of the Lord means. We see it in the Bible all the time. What does science think about that? Read 2 Peter. Does quantum mechanics say we have free will? Is it possible to have free will? Good God, bad world, that's theodicy. Maybe you have some very powerful environmentalists in your world, in your group of friends, who see the world through the environmental prism. We must preserve the world that God has given. Are they right? Are they wrong? Does the Bible support them? Where should we think about that? Can there be thinking machines? Artificial intelligence, what does that really mean? There's a great 3 Blue, 1 Brown on that, by the way. If you haven't watched it, you must. Getting down, what is a person? Forgetting about artificial intelligence, what does it mean in the psychology world? In the physics world, we could talk about inflation a lot. In the quantum mechanics world, the Cambrian explosion is a huge thing. This is the time they found these fossils up in Canada. The world seems, according to these fossils, to have gone from very boring little creatures to creatures with seven-sided symmetry, all kind. It was like a science fiction nightmare. That was how the world looked at this one blink in time in the Cambrian period, all discovered by accident by these Canadian paleontologists who had a flat tire near the side of a mountain, and the guy picked up a rock when he got out to fix the tire, and it was this trilobite that no one ever seen the likes of. It was a fossil of a trilobite. He and his buddies walked up the hill, and it started like the biggest thing in paleontology ever. And it's a sticking point for all of paleoevolutionary biology. And finally, Freud always asked, that was his last words, what women want, apparently. Anyway, that was good. Thank you for paying attention, and we'll take a couple questions if you have them. Okay. Thank you. Any good quick questions? Any 8, 10 questions? According to theory or tradition, Freud's last words were, women, what is it they want?